Thank you, Asada. The feeling is entirely mutual. I just adore this young woman, and I hold her in such high regard. I think one of the great joys of being a teacher is to quickly see your students outstrip you and go on to do amazing things. And Asada, I take my hat off to you for what you've achieved, in addition to having two children the last few years. So I am going to talk to you today about work that I have done with Professor Ben Saul and my husband, Ron Callum. I want to begin, however, by acknowledging the elders past and present of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I now come from an area in Australia where I acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. But this is my hometown, guys, and I am so proud of everything that you do. I tell everyone that Melbourne is the human rights capital of Australia. And you are, aren't you?
Yes.
Yes, good. You don't need persuading. So, okay, armed conflicts and natural disasters both cause impairments and pose acute challenges for people with disabilities. But for a variety of reasons, these people, for too long, have been neglected and often ignored in both disaster planning and in management. And in fact, the UN High Commissioner of Refugees passed now, Antonio Guterres, described refugees with disabilities as the forgotten refugees. Now, for those of you who know us, you'll know that my husband Ron McCallum is blind, he was born blind. You may know also that he was asked and stood for election to the Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities in 2008. He went on to become the chair of that committee, and in fact the chair of the committee of chairs of all human rights instruments. Now, we have had the most extraordinary journey together, and we undertook from the time of his election that this journey would be part of our story as well. So for those of you who know him, and as it has now told you, I've had a small obsession with actually vulnerable migrants for many years, children in particular. And I thought, well, why not persons with disabilities? It's part of my story, it's part of what I do. And so we decided to put our name forward to AusAid as it then was, now DFAT, and reasons better known to them, they backed us and said, go out, go forth. And so we did. We ended up doing, over a period of 3 years, a study of six countries, starting in our region with Malaysia and Indonesia, then going to Pakistan and to Uganda. So we covered off, the subcontinent, sort of. And Africa, and then we finished in Jordan and Turkey with a case study on the Syrian refugees, and it really gave us an extraordinary insight. It put me in harm's way in a way that I don't think I could do ever again. I couldn't cope with it, frankly, and it left me quite profoundly shocked. I was also told by my university that if I did that again, it would not come back. Because I didn't have the insurance that would cover where I ended up. So, anyway, I want to just start today by saying that the interface between the human rights of persons with disabilities and disasters has at least three dimensions that I want to explore with you. First is factual, insofar as the enjoyment of human rights is one that creates disabilities. The second is legal, reflecting on the obligations of states to protect the people who are affected. And the third is operational. And that's a dimension that really reflects the role that human rights should be playing in managing the situation and proposing strategies for people in this situation. So, look, can I say, when we started this research, it really was quite new. I think because of the CRPD, it's become a bigger and bigger issue internationally, but it just stands a testament to how new all of this is, that when we went to Malaysia in 2012, or was it 2013? I'm losing count now. No, it was 2012, I think. We were told quite confidently I'm the head of UNHCR. Now, UNHCR is a partner in our research. We're told quite confidently that of 100,000 refugees, there were 202 who were people who could be described as persons with disabilities. 202. What does the World Health Organization tell us of the proportion in any given population anywhere in the world? Correct. I can see your lips move. Around 12%, 12 to 15%, 4 to 6% with serious grave disabilities. The only people that they were picking up, the only people who were acknowledged by them as having a psychosocial disability were people who were actually babies who had were described as having developmental delays. Now, the reason for this that we were told is that people with disabilities, it's very sad, but they don't travel. Can't travel, they've got disabilities, okay? So really, an important part of our research was to document the extent to which they do travel and they are represented. Now we know for a fact that when there are major catastrophes, who suffers first and most grievously? Women, children, and people with disabilities. The tsunami that took out 250,000 people, persons with disabilities, overrepresented in the number of people who were killed and injured in that. So it stands to reason that this is a problem. Now, I told you I shouldn't have been in charge of opening slides, but I thought late afternoon you need some pictures. So I'm going to put some up for you. This is a very famous picture of delivery of aid in Aleppo to massive people who have been caught there. Can you just imagine what a person with a disability, how they would fare in trying to get to the front of a queue like that? Yeah? Okay. I'll put up my next slide, which is a picture of the Syrian border and why I'm not allowed to go back there. yes. Anyway, I'll tell you offline some of the things we got up to, but maybe not here. What I want to turn to now is the legal dimension of situations like this. So there are some areas of law. It's very interesting. I've actually, because of this project, got very interested in international humanitarian law and refugee law, as well as human rights law. And what you find is that there's obviously very old areas of law that have been there for a long time, many of whom, like IHL, for example, international humanitarian law, came about because of really vulnerable people who are being injured in conflicts. And if you go through IHL, and I've got an article on this, it was published in the Monash Law Review, I think. I go through in detail how IHL responded to persons with disabilities. The point is, though, that the further back you go, the more you get in law the idea of charity, medical assistance, welfare, if you like, approach to people who need helping. Where the CRPD, the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, has been an absolute revolution, is that it has moved us away from a welfare model into a model of rights-based law. Now, before I talk about the CRPD, I just want to say something about refugee law, because in many respects, I think refugee law is, well, it has been the first legal point of call for people who are displaced across borders and who are in need of protection. This audience probably don't need reminding that the definition of refugee is someone who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group or political opinion, is outside the country of his Sikh nationality and is unable or owing to such fear is unwilling to avail himself to the protection of that country. I'm trying to make my presentation accessible. Okay. You'll also know that the centrepiece of the Refugee Convention is Article 33, which I've put up on the board and I won't read it to you, but that contains what is known as the non-refoulement obligation. which operates to modify the otherwise sovereign rights of states in their dealings with non-citizens. Now, what you may not know is that Articles 3 through 34 of the Convention operate in theory, if not in practice always, as an elaborate human rights instrument for persons who meet the definition of refugee. Now, of course, the problem with that definition is that it only applies to refugees. And although persons with disabilities are just as likely to meet the definition as anyone else, it is one that is inherently limited. And for that reason, in recent years, a number of people have begun to look beyond the Convention. And for children, we're looking increasingly to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Persons with disabilities to the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Now, some happy snaps of our field work in Pakistan. I'll just make a point that this work couldn't have been done without the assistance of UNHCR in all the countries that we visited, nor indeed without the assistance of the amazing people who helped us. But in Pakistan, so what we did was we in each country we went and interviewed a series of people with disabilities in displacement situations. In Pakistan, however, we actually worked with UNHCR and they gave us access to data on close to 1 million refugees. And what I want to say to you is that the significance of the Pakistan work in particular is that it allowed us to see the difference between the traditional approach that UNHCR had been taking to disability, the approach that really left you with 202 out of 94,000 being recognised as refugees, to a situation where they were coming up with data much closer to what the World Health Organization was saying they should be finding. So very quickly, our research actually turned into a project that was looking at A, the impact of the CRPD on the operation of UNHCR and on people in displacement. UNHCR are a particularly good partner to have in this because if the Red Cross is often the first on the ground in situations that aren't conflict, when people move across borders, increasingly UNHCR has become a frontline relief agency. So actually reaching out to them and seeing what they were doing, I think was very important. So the next article I want to put up for you is, I want to talk now about how the CRPD has really created a revolution for people with disabilities. The first article I'm putting up for you, perhaps a little counterintuitively, is Article 11. And you see, here's the thing. I said to you before that there have been structures of international law over many years that have tried to reach out to people who are vulnerable in displacement situations. We've had IHL, we've had refugee law, and we've had human rights law, right? The ICCPR and all the rest of it. But if you actually look closely at human rights law, for example, in situations of emergencies, the conventions give you the right to actually suspend the operation of them. And in even IHL, it's all about assisting people, but it doesn't really see people as rights bearers so much. And the same is true for the Refugee Convention, which makes no mention whatsoever of persons with disabilities. Flash forward to Article 11 of the CRPD. This was drafted in the direct aftermath of the big tsunami in 2004. And it's the first ever human rights instrument that actually refers both to IHL and to situations of emergency and does more than say, you cannot suspend the operation of this convention. It actually says states, parties shall, in accordance with their obligations under international law, take all necessary measures to ensure the protection and safety of persons with disabilities in situations of risk, including situations of armed conflict, humanitarian emergencies, and the occurrence of natural disasters. Okay? Now that is truly revolutionary. Convention on the Rights of the Child mentions IHL and has a whole structure for child soldiers. But here, for the first time, they say that's not enough, and you must acknowledge this convention to confer rights on people with disabilities. They can't be forgotten anymore. Let me take you then to Article 1 of the convention, because I want to talk about, well, who is a person with disabilities and why is it important to count them and to modify your approach to them, because that really was at the heart of our research at the end of the day. Article 1 says the purpose of this convention is to promote, protect and ensure the full and equal enjoyment of all human rights and fundamental freedoms by all persons with disabilities and to promote respect for their inherent dignity. Then it says, persons with disabilities include those who have long-term physical, mental, intellectual or sensory impairments which in interaction with various barriers may hinder their full and effective participation in society on an equal basis with others. Now those words are significant because what they do is they say, and this is the crux of the message I want to give you this afternoon, disability is not just about impairment. Disability is about a failure of a society to accommodate, and the notion of the reasonable accommodation of a person with disability is the centrepiece of the CRPD, just as much as Article 23 is the centrepiece of the Refugee Convention. The obligation to make a reasonable accommodation for a person with disability. To put it in visceral terms, when I take my glasses off, I have an impairment. If you take my glasses away for long enough, I have a disability. It's not as profound as my husband's, as I keep saying, but he is actually quite concerned that I do have correct accommodation, as I have the eyes of the family. Do you get what I'm trying to say to you? And so it's not losing a limb that makes you disabled. It's not having something to stand on, to hold on to, that makes you impaired. So, no idea what the next one is. Oh yes, here we go. Okay, so what we tried to do in our project, how are we going? 5 minutes, excellent. What we tried to do in our project is to take a CRPD approach to the identification of disability and to gently persuade the UNHCR. They came in as our partners. Can I just say right now that from the get-go, they stood beside us and have worked with us through what we are doing. We, of course, progressed on the shoulders of the giants who before us had been working on what Article 1 of the CRPD means in terms of identifying and accommodating people with disabilities. The essence of the message is contained in what was devised originally by a group based in Washington and that we refer to as the Washington Group, who explain that in order to identify persons with disabilities, it's not enough to ask, do you have an impairment? And this ultimately is what we found was happening with UNHCR and other relief agencies. They were doing visual identification of people with disabilities. So if people were blind, if they lost a limb, if they were utterly non-compos mentis, they would be kicked up straight away as having a disability. But if they had anything that was not visible, they weren't getting picked up. So what the Washington SEP group did is that they developed questionnaires that did not just ask, are you blind? Are you deaf? They would say, do you have a problem seeing? Do you have what you need to accommodate your vision problem? Do you have problems hearing? Do you need a hearing aid? Do you have a hearing aid? Do you have, and so what we've done, we devised a questionnaire that took us through everything from the sensory, the senses, so hearing, sight, through to cognitive and to experiences of pain, okay? And we did it on the basis that you you don't ask, you don't find out. And we found, for example, in Malaysia, we were given access through UNHCR to people with disabilities. And we found that when we went out and interviewed them and the others, one thing in every country that we went to, we would be absolutely swamped by people coming and saying, this is the first time anybody has ever asked questions about us. And so the word just spread like wildfire. We got swamped in Uganda by so many people that over a 3-week period, we went with 300 paper questionnaires. In the end, we almost had to throw them to the crowd. By the time we left, in the middle of these incredibly remote, this is Malaysia, this is where we were in Uganda. You wondered how we got stressed. By the time we left, we had a box of 1,000 questionnaires. In the middle of that, people found places where they could photocopy. We told them, if you can fill the forms in English or French, we can cope with the answers. I happen to speak French. 1,000 people. And time and time again, we would find that people had not had anything like the full range of their disabilities recorded. And if you don't know, how can you make accommodation? And we persuaded UNHCR that if you don't ask the question, then how are they going to raise the money if you don't know who is in your cohort? So compare what happened in Malaysia with the questionnaire that they used in Pakistan 2 years later, you see, by the time we got there, and they were using the Washington group. And you know what? They came back with still a modest figures, but 9 to 10% of the cohort. Incidentally, if you don't ask, you don't know, we also found the most extraordinary things came out when we questioned people from Uganda, for example. We found that almost 100% of the women and children that we interviewed had been subject to sexual violence as a result of their displacement and the remote location. So really, I think our most important finding is that this was absolutely the tip of the iceberg. There are a range of cultural reasons why people don't volunteer, relatives or their own disabilities, and you can understand that because you tend not to be chosen for resettlement if people know that you have a disability. But ultimately, that attitudes to disability and displacement have really been antediluvian. It's been slow to develop. Having said that, the good news is that in recent times, there's more and more initiatives. I was invited to speak to the United Nations last year to present our research. We have a book contract. Our research will be published by Elgar early next year, we hope. They met in, ironically, Istanbul very recently and produced a set of guidelines on how people with disabilities should be treated in displacement. So it's been a huge, huge learning curve for me, but a huge privilege to really be at one of the cutting edges of international human rights law. And I think I'd like to finish on that positive note, because there is still a lot to be done, but it's not completely off the page anymore. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mary, for that very thought-provoking talk.